This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, Ramsey Clark at 85 delivers a special birthday message.
But now, Canada's largest union in several key sectors, including forestry, energy, media, and telecommunications, at a conference confronting the climate crisis. Can labor help shape an effective strategy? They urged thumbs down on the Keystone XL, oppose export pipelines such as Keystone XL that kill off our oil resources and kill jobs in the process. To deal with the unfolding ecological policies crisis, we must jettison corporation-centric economic policies in favor of ones that address our world's social and ecological concerns.
Let's now listen to David Coles, president of the Communication, Energy, and Paperworkers Union of Canada, with a message to Obama. No to the Keystone XL pipeline.
It is really gratifying to see this many people concerned about an issue that for many, many years, our union stood almost by itself in opposition to the building of the pipelines from Canada to the U.S. Our union did, by a convention mandate of all of its delegates, unanimously endorse and support the Kyoto Accord. And our members are the workers who work in the tar sands, in refineries, on pipelines, and any facet of the oil and gas industry, but our members in that sector said there's something wrong with this model and we need to address it. How did we get our members to oppose? Well, we engaged them a long time ago in the debates around capitalism. We talked about it. You don't have to tell an oil worker who has worked in the industry in a while, how rotten the employers are. They don't trust them. And when the employer goes to bed with the gov, they don't trust the gov either. They've been hammered and job loss, killed by unsafe procedures, the whole gamut of what happens to workers. And I would take credit, not myself, but our movement, of connecting the dots for a lot of our members, that if the boss supports it, you better be nervous. We're not in this together. We have opposing interests. Right? We are, in the United States and Canada, the law is a confrontational system when it comes to labor relations. They've got all of the rights unless we take it away from them. The issue of the pipelines from Canada, primarily from the tar sands, and I'll stop you there for a minute. I've been there many times, and most likely not many of you have had. There is no tar in the tar sands. There is also no oil in the tar sands. It has to be cracked. It has to be processed to convert it to synthetic oil that then gets refined. We've been using the term the bitumen sands, and that's what it is, and that's a politically correct, nice word. I recommend you use what it looks like it is, gooey, mucky tar. So tar sands are fine for us. We have opposed the export of unprocessed bitumen, tar sands, to the United States for about 8 or 9 years now. We got our butt kicked at every judicial turn of the way opposing the building of the XL pipeline and its earlier cousin. We had very little support, believe it or not, and I think it's a fair criticism from the environmental movement either. It just wasn't on anybody's radar. And our members consistently, our members not just in the union at large, because remember, 120,000 members of which 35,000, 40,000 work in the industry, just consistently said, just keep going. So one convention, one conference after another, you got to oppose the export of raw bitumen. And we lost all the way down until, thanks to our sisters and brothers and comrades in the United States, somebody got to the president and he shook his head and said no. And that actually inspired the environmental movement probably around the world, but particularly in Canada, to continue the battle, not just on the XL pipeline, but on a number of other export pipelines that were being proposed to export raw bitumen. So what is our position on the tar sands? It's a four-legged stool by our point of view. And if one of the legs is missing, then it should stop and not be expanded or enlarged. And those four legs of that stool, from our point of view, are first, the export of raw bitumen is a job killer in Canada. Not much of importance to many Americans, but it's a job killer in Canada, really important to us. It is bad for the Canadian economy. So the Canadian dollar is out of whack by 20%, 15%. I'm not an economist. I'm only reading their reports that the oil side of the economy in Canada has skewed the value of the Canadian dollar and subsequently killed hundreds of thousands of manufacturing jobs in Canada. So another big Canadian issue. One issue seldom talked about in the United States, and I would urge you to follow now on the web and Twitter. Our point of view is that the oil companies and the Crown, the country of Canada, has to come to terms with First Nations rights. We have a treaty system in Canada, and some... Thank you. It is a big deal. Watch for a group called Idle No More, and we have had protests and arrests escalating over the last 3 months. Now, because of a hunger strike by a Northern Canadian First Nations chief around the abuse and the violation of First Nations rights. And much of that has to do with the building of pipelines through their traditional lands and extraction in their territories. The Canadian government has violated the Canadian Constitution by making changes to acts that govern water and the environment that infringe upon First Nations. And they're, quite frankly, telling the Canadian people and the Canadian government enough's enough. Finally, the last stool of the leg is the environment. We cannot sustain the expansion of a carbon economy. My 10 and 11 and 12-year-old grandchildren know that. I mean, they don't buy any of the nonsense around carbon. They know we have to. We must transition out of a carbon-based economy to a sustainable, renewable, whatever the word green means. We also represent a whole pile of forestry workers, and we have some views on sustainable economy and the use of the forest as well, but I shall stick to the point. The environment is fundamental for those who work in the industry. And then the question is always, and I got to tell you that unlike the U.S., because the last time I was supposed to come and speak to this group, a number of trade unions in the United States threatened to boycott picket if I showed up. And so, you know, valor being usually not one of my best traits, but I decided not to infringe upon the university's program, and I didn't come. But in Canada, other than the U.S.-based construction unions, the labor movement supports our position. The labor movement supports the position we're taking on the export of raw bitumen and transitioning to a green economy. We belong to an organization with the Steelworkers of America, a blue-green coalition that is doing tremendous work trying to convince and pressure the government and employers that we have to transition to a green economy. So we have good support within the political realm of the opposition in Canada. The opposition, the leader of the opposition party, has taken some very courageous positions on oil sands and on a carbon-based economy. So what do you do with my dues-paying members who, by a action of society, you, me, others, say we can't have a carbon society? We have to then look very seriously and realistically as how do you transition not just the workers, but the communities that were based on those industries into good-paying, sustainable jobs. So you need to continually think. You can't just turn the key on carbon. First, there's a number of us in northern Canada would probably freeze to death. You know, when you talk about transition away from carbon, there is some practical issues about how our nation was built. Doesn't mean it can't be done at all. But you've got to think about the transition and a just transition for workers and their community when society makes the determination that it is about to make, I believe, that we have to move away from a carbon-based economy. I don't support capitalism. I think it's a screwed-up system. I got to tell you, we really got hammered in Canada during the Great Recession, Depression, whatever you want to call 2007, 2008, 2009. And a number on the left, including myself, at the beginning thought, this will maybe be the remaking of a kinder, gentler capitalism. Well, it's nonsense. Well, just think about that we have to repair capitalism. Well, first off, repair it from what? It was designed to do what it's doing. It is not broken. Capitalism is not broken. It's doing exactly what it was intended to do. Make a few people rich and the rest of us not so rich, and in many cases, poor, starving, and dying. So I, quite frankly, have no patience for anyone that says, well, we just need to tweak it because then it'll get better. It'll get better for a very few. But the system is not built for you and I, never was. And we need to think about that when we talk about transitioning to a sustainable economy, a green sustainable economy. In my union, we lost in the forest sector, between us and a couple of other unions, 100,000 forestry jobs in about 3 or 4 years through that period of time. And when you lose your job in a one-horse town, you don't just lose your job. You lose your house because it was worth a couple $100,000. It's now worth, some people were buying them on credit cards, $5,000. But you lose your community. Community can't function. So the whole issue of the economy in a carbon-based society has all kinds of implications. So what do we do? I don't like to just be a naysayer. You got to have a takeaway what to do. So for, I hope, our allies south of the 49th, you've got to turn the heat up on President Obama. All you need him to do is shake his head. Doesn't have to say very much. All he has to do is shake his head and say, no, they're not going to allow the building of the XL pipeline on the Continental 49, right? Below the 49. Just do whatever you have to do. And how do you do that? Well, quite frankly, I've been arrested already once in Canada for resisting the XL pipeline. Myself and a number of others got arrested for disobeying the gendarmes. Organized civil society was there with us, along with First Nations. And it, once again, retaught us that we must resist, we must, and including civil disobedience. Don't let them build the pipeline. So what else can you do? Well, the regular stuff. Follow what's going on. Be informed of what the real issues are. Don't get, you get bombed by it far more than we do, but the Fox Network, right? It's not even fantasy, it's just straight lies. But don't get washed in with it. Be informed, understand, and talk about it. Talk about it in the church, wherever you are, that what is happening to North America around those pipelines and the use of carbon is detrimental to society as a whole, regardless of where you're from. And so you need to be able to speak out and speak out loudly. And the labor movement in the United States is, in fact, other than those that are in the American-based construction building unions, are, in fact, very seriously engaging in that debate in the United States and around the world. Do whatever you can to argue for a just and reasonable, renewable, green economy. Thank you.
Now, what an incredible thing to see such a huge union, the Energy and Paper Workers Union of Canada, with a message from David Coles, its president, saying no to the Keystone XL pipeline. We move along. Mumia Abu-Jamal, journalist, activist, political prisoner, in tribute to Ramsey Clark, said, when the bombs were being readied for Afghanistan and the White House was swearing vengeance, who dared to stage rallies predicting disaster? Abu Ghraib, Pakistan-Palestine drone strikes, and wild Islamophobia fueled by fear and ignorance. Who opposed these developments at every step?
And as capitalism sent jobs abroad, hollowing out the middle class, causing dystopian heels in inner cities, who spoke out against the rapacious greed of Wall Street and the resultant prison-industrial complex and the death penalty of death row? Ramsey Clark and the organization he helped to found in two small groups of his law office, the International Action Center, IAC, 20 years ago.
That he took some of the toughest cases in the nation and with the IAC fought some of the toughest battles against the might of the empire is telling and high tribute. And a final thought. If King were alive today, he'd be a year younger than Ramsey, 84. This, a tribute from Mumia Abu-Jamal. And now we listen to Ramsey Clark giving his message to us on his 85th birthday.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a little embarrassed, but not being very modest, I can stand it. Been through worse ordeals, but I don't really remember when offhand. But it's nice to be here. Remember Lincoln met a guy on the road outside of Springfield, just been tarred and feathered, and he asked me how it felt, and the guy said, well, except the honor of it, I'd just sooner walked. I know exactly how he felt. I want to talk briefly about one thing, but before I do, I want to say something special about Hugo Chavez. He's one of the great leaders of our time. If a person doesn't have heroes, he's got a complex that's not healthy. And Hugo Chavez has a hero, and you can't talk with him for 5 minutes if he doesn't mention Simón Bolívar, the great liberator. But I'm a history buff and student, and I can assure you that Hugo Chavez has liberated more people in more countries. Of course, there's a lot more people to liberate than when Simón Bolívar was around, but than Simón Bolívar could have ever counted. The service that he's provided for the poor in Latin America, the political freedom he's given to half a dozen countries that were struggling against the domination of their bully neighbor to the north is unprecedented in the history of this hemisphere. And maybe the rest of the hemispheres. How many are there? What I do want to talk about was raised on April the 4th, 1967 here by Martin Luther King in this church, 1 year to the day before he was murdered. And what he said hurt him terribly. He sent me a note that I still treasure and a copy of the speech. He wanted to be sure I got it right, what he really said, and how hard it was for him to say what he did, but it was that my own country is the greatest purveyor of violence on earth. He gave his life to change that. Violence couldn't stand a man that believed that way. But the violence that's now pervaded exceeds anything that the world has known. And we have to do everything within our power as individuals and collectively to stop it. In the last 2 years, and I'll just give two illustrations, I've been in three trials. I think they're the only trials as an expert witness, not as a, they didn't use lawyers. These were basically Catholic radicals who don't like violence, don't hate anything, but don't like war, for sure. And they were trying to, by putting their bodies on the line at air bases in the United States where the decision to fire drones are made. And the trial, in each of the trials, it became so clear. Interesting to watch the difficulty of even hardened judges and hearing the evidence. But here are these men just outside of Syracuse and on an air base and 40 miles north of Las Vegas on an air base. They're pilots, because somebody had the idea that pilots would have a better instinct as to when to punch the button. And they're watching a screen, and it's got shadowy pictures of a highway or whatever it happens to be, and a truck coming down to it. They're waiting to see the right moment to punch the button to fire the missile to destroy who's ever in that truck. How many thousands of miles away, halfway around the world, generally. The idea that you can assassinate people around the world without their ability to even know that they're in danger. They may think they're safe when they're sleeping at home in their bed. And on what evidence? And the president himself says he makes the decision. What's his decision worth? No decision is worth more than the evidence or information on which it's based. And what does he know? He knows what the CIA tells him. You know, I can tell you that when I was the governor, I had Helms, who was head of the CIA, in Houston, who was his top counsel, come in and lie to me in the face about whether there's some planes in, on an air base, not an air base, a public airport in Buffalo, New York, were CIA or not. He said they weren't, and they were. Would they not say that to the president? But even if they would, you read our Constitution, and if you think we would ever fall to the level that we would assassinate someone who we suspected, and we thought this shadowy person might be him, and we didn't care who the half dozen others in the vehicle were, or didn't know who in the house, who else was in the house, and yet we kill them all. The people that will tolerate that are in trouble, and we're the people. We have to try to put an end to it. The other thing is what we've done with nuclear arms. We've got a machine that can take out the biggest country in the world. It can take out a continent, perhaps. It's called the Trident II nuclear submarine. And the evidence that we obtained, and you have to presume it's the least damaging presentation that could have been made by the government, is that this was a specific fleet, a specific Trident II nuclear fleet. 30 subs, that doesn't sound like too many. They're big monsters, though. They're a lot bigger around than this room, and they're 400 feet long. They carry normally 140 nuclear warheads and missiles. They only have two calibers. The smallest caliber is about 12 times that of the bomb that incinerated Hiroshima in Belleville. The bigger one leaves a crater, they say. What do I know? They say 50 miles in diameter. Imagine trying to find a point around the metropolitan area where we are right now in which you would detonate the bomb to kill the largest population. And that's just in the crater. That doesn't include what gets caught up in the blast that goes out from there. You kill 25 million people. And imagine one ship with 140 warheads like that. Try and think of 140 cities in Europe. I think for a long time, think of that many. Think of the biggest ones first, because you're in the business of killing. You have eight of those on alert in the Pacific alone. at all times. If that's not madness, I don't know what is. How could you use one of those bombs? And you've got 140 at the fingertip of one ship's captain. Attention must be paid, as we've been told. And if we can't act radically and quickly to turn that around, to slash our military budget by 80%, to put in food for people who are hungry and starving, and all the things that are needed around the world and here, and stop our assault on the environment, which is getting angry with us. And you or I would be too if we were treated that way. So while we know that organizations like the IAC and great and imaginative leaders like Hugo Chavez have done great deeds for people, we have an unprecedented challenge and must engage it and pursue it for the miles that we have before we sleep. Thanks so much for helping me celebrate my non-birthday.
And you were listening to Ramsey Clark on his 85th birthday and counting. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.